Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. Hope you had a great week so far. It's Saturday morning. It's that time again. It's a Doc Talk podcast hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dr. Greg Roscoe. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss the show and you catch it later and you're sitting around roasting marshmallows in a kumbaya setting, catch it on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So, more him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, the threes. Doc, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing a great guest again, as you usually do on your show.
Well, thank you so much for the introductions, Mark. I am doing well. You know, the show is doing well. The number of emails continue to increase, as you know. People can get a hold of me, gjrmd308@outlook.com. We have really a tremendous guest on the program this morning. We have Dr. Deborah Gilman. She is a doctor of psychology, fantastic training. She did go to one of the most prestigious colleges in the country. That was Carnegie Mellon. She did graduate with honors, and she then went on to get a master's degree as well as a PhD degree in clinical child psychology. She is practicing in the Fox Chapel area. My God, she's been to several great institutions practicing. And we want to talk a little bit today. We have a variety of topics with regard to relationships, relationship crises, co-parenting. You know, what about stress, trauma? What happens in divorce? You know, when people need help, how do they get help? Where do they go for help? And indeed, that's what Dr. Gilman does. And, you know, we wonder a little bit about, well, when they go to a psychologist, what happens? You know, what questions do they need to answer? You know, how does she go ahead and start gathering information? You know, with regard to medicine, and it's going to be more of her shortly, more than I, you know, we talk about the four pillars. You know, we talk about information, listening to the patient. We then do our physical examination. Then we do the third pillar, our diagnostic testing. And then the fourth pillar, of course, is decision making. Psychology is a little different, and that's why we have an expert on to talk about it. And, you know, Dr. Gilman, we've talked about the love languages before. We've had a psychologist on talking about love language. Very popular show with a lot of questions. And, you know, I know with regard to your outreach, with regard to what you're publishing, you have done something on the five love languages. Maybe we can get into that as well. So, Dr. Gilman, thank you for being here. We're going to start. Please tell us about yourself, Doctor. Go ahead.
Sure. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I am really excited to be here. So as you know, Dr. Roscoe said, I am a licensed psychologist. I'm also a mediator and a coach. I strongly believe in wellness and family wellness. So a lot of my passion with the couples and the families and the children that I work with is helping them move through difficult life experiences to hopefully reduce the impact of some of these experiences on the development of the children, but also the development of the whole family. We know that when you have significant, almost traumatic life experiences and traumatic life experiences, that those things can stay in your body as well as in your mind, and they can affect you for not only your lifetime, but generations to come. Really fascinating stuff about epigenetics we could probably get into in another day and another topic. But really my goals in working with individuals is to really help them define the issues that are important to them so that they can improve their own interpersonal relationships and interpersonal healing and coping to move themselves forward, both as individuals and as families.
Wow. That sounds like a big job, Dr. Gilman. You know, it sounds like an important job. It sounds overall, how do you get the data? How do you get the information to start implementing treatment or taking tools out of your toolbox to help people that have been traumatized or stressed or people, you know, going through a divorce, people going through co-parenting that maybe aren't the best parents? How do you do all that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when people come into my office, I really view our work together as a collaborative treatment that's based on the relationship between myself as a psychologist and the individual or the family. So a lot of what we do as psychologists is talk, right? I want to provide a supportive environment that allows the family to talk openly to someone who's objective, neutral, non-judgmental. I mean, that is really key. I use a lot of curiosity and trying to understand what's important to somebody and in a very supportive, non-judgmental way. And then we do apply scientifically validated procedures to help people develop healthier, more effective habits. I am cognitive behavioral based, so I do a lot of looking at what you're feeling and how it links to what you're thinking and what you're doing. So actions, feelings, and thoughts and how they all relate to one another. And as humans, we have, you know, many thoughts that go unnoticed throughout our day that can get in our way of helpful behaviors. So we may explore those things and work together, sometimes with co-parents, sometimes children and their parents, and sometimes children alone. When I work with kids, we do a lot of play, we do a lot of art. It's amazing that children can learn, and most children learn a lot through play. So I see kids very young, sometimes as young as 3. When I was in the hospital system, I worked with toddlers and their parents on behavior problems, or just getting parents to understand child development and for parents to work together to be the best parents that they want to be so they can have relationship satisfaction. We know that adding a baby to a couple increases the stress in that family, positive stress and negative stress, right? Children are stressful. And so we do a lot of things to sort of baby-proof your relationship and help people not go into that downward slide that happens after a baby, because we know then that can lead to divorce. And so my job is always on prevention. I want couples to be as strong as they can. I want families to be as strong as they can, because we know that that can really, that really buffers for everybody and can help people thrive as they move forward, especially kids.
Wow, super. You know, you mentioned the word prevention. And, you know, as far as baby-proofing a relationship, do you ever talk to families before they have a child and say, hey, you know, your lives are going to change, the relationship is going to change with this baby, that, you know, maybe the wife is unable to cater to the husband as much as she once did. It's attention to that baby. I mean, do you kind of baby-proof it preventively before, or is it most of the time it's after the child is born in the home that maybe problems start to develop? Maybe there's this loss of love that goes on after a baby is born between the husband and wife. You know, how do you do all that? You know, what do you see, and what's the best way to approach it?
Yeah, so ideally I like to work with parents before the baby comes into their home, whether they're pregnant or maybe they're adopting. And I have partnered with pediatricians before. So when parents go in and they meet a pediatrician and they try to vet the pediatrician, I would love for the pediatrician to say, hey, and here's another resource that you guys can use before the baby comes, because it's not just everything that's going to happen in that delivery room and happen with the baby after. Your relationship is going to be so important to preserving the attachment for your baby and connecting with your baby and maintaining connection with you. So again, we discuss, when I have people come into my office, we really discuss what they feel their role is as a parent, reflect on their own personal family backgrounds. Everybody's background is different. I have yet to meet two people who come into my office and they match on everything in every way. And that's a good thing, right? Because we want moms, dads to be different from one another. We want parents to be different because those values create a well-rounded kid. But we also want them to talk about them, because then if they don't talk about them, they could cause conflict, right? Which then disrupts that attachment. So I really place an emphasis on fathering. I think sometimes, to your point, you know, doctor, that men don't necessarily always know how to come in and support, and they maybe even feel like they don't have a job in the beginning. So we do a lot of warm fathering, and we talk about the importance of fathers, because they really do add to the child's life in such an amazing way. And to help not to just feel that maybe mom is the gatekeeper to that relationship, even if it's unintentional, I think sometimes, you know, how do you allow sharing in the joy for both parents?
Sure.
And so we want to discuss roles and goals, warm fathering, how to tag team together, how to repair conflict in healthy, positive ways, and how to really work together for win-win solutions. And then creating these rituals of connecting that maintain that we-ness, right? Like the we as a couple. And it doesn't even take like having a babysitter or anything. You could, when the baby's napping, watch a show, you know, put on Netflix or cook a meal together or even take a shower together, you know, do some positive touch, massage, even if people aren't ready to be intimate. There are ways that you can connect in really positive ways together. So I love to see a couple, this is my long, you know, long-winded, but I love to see a couple before they have the baby, because they can talk about all these things and put a plan in place.
Got it. Well, you know, excellent explanation, Dr. Gilman. You know, as far as, say, doing this, you know, after a child is born in a relationship, you know, I think we're aware of, you know, the love languages, the five love languages. Is that so important or more important after a baby is born between a couple to go ahead and maintain their love and their caring, doing things for each other that, you know, maybe with the baby now they've stopped doing, and then marriage tends to be a little bit rougher, et cetera. Do you try to implement the love language at all?
I do. And, you know, what's interesting is people, before they have the baby, think their love language might be one thing, and it can actually shift after you have a baby. Maybe the person who is more about, you know, words of affirmation now feels mostly loved when someone does an act of service for them instead of giving them the praise, actually being proactive and doing something that eases the other person's, you know, daily stressors or takes some obligation off of them as a parent. So I think it is important to explore that, particularly if you have had an idea about what your love language was prior to baby coming. You might want to evaluate, you know, 3, even 6 months after the baby comes and say, hold on a second, I think we've shifted. Because without that connection, you might be doing a million things for your partner, thinking that you're connecting to them and that you're really showing that you support and appreciate them, and it's just going over the other person's head because that's not what they need at this moment in the relationship.
Oh, very good. And, you know, as far as, say, that the love languages, you know, just to review a little bit, you know, we can talk about that. You know, the words of affirmation, quality time, physical touch, acts of service, receiving gifts, you know, and it's the partners, again, as you mentioned, should maybe reanalyze that. But also they should look at themselves and say, hey, has my love language changed? Is there something I need now that I didn't need before that can be communicated to the relationship to maintain it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that can maintain that relationship satisfaction and longevity. So to be able to say, hold on a second, I'm not feeling or experiencing love in the same way as I used to, and I'm feeling disconnected.
Right.
Why is that? Look within. Absolutely.
And that's so hard to do, though, is it not? You know, in the heat of battle,
trying
to look within and say, hey, you know, I'm a little different now. Let me communicate that. Let me go ahead and make sure my spouse understands, you know, what I'm going through. I mean, it's a very difficult time, especially when, you know, you're raising a child or raising several children. You've got a job. You have a mortgage payment. Maybe it's hard to look at those things, which causes an awful lot of stress in a relationship setting. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And that's why I like to say to put aside some time to create a daily stress-reducing conversation. And it might not even be stress about your relationship. There might be something going on, you know, at work or with the house that you just need to really set some time aside and talk about it and feel like, again, we're a we and we're facing the world as a team, like that I got your back. And if you can listen to your partner for that self-soothing, it makes you feel, again, so much more connected. If you can take even 10 minutes of your day to sit down and connect and, you know, look at each other, that
sure.
can completely transform how you feel in the relationship.
And, you know, as far as I think that's wonderful, you know, the taking the time to reanalyze, to rethink, to look at what's going on. And then, you know, overall, you know, if you understand what your partner's love language is it possible to use the other love languages also? And, you know, maybe they want to be touched. Is it okay to go ahead and say, hey, honey, I just bought you a new bracelet. You know, would you like to have that? You know, I'm going to go ahead and do X, Y, and Z for you. Can you mix those all up as well to make the relationship more interesting?
Absolutely. It's not all or nothing, right? I mean, even though you might have a primary love language, a lot of us have secondary love languages. And, you know, who doesn't want to get a surprise with, you know, a bouquet of flowers
sure.
or, you know, something else
yeah.
for them or, you know, a back rub or, you know, a kiss in the kitchen, something like that, you know, that you can just take these, I call them like these mindless moments and turn them into mindful moments where you actually take a moment to connect. I mean, we all have the same 24 hours in a day, and a lot of those days fill up. So you might not have time to set aside for that daily conversation. And that's okay, but you could have a mindful moment where you really put your energy into your partner, even in a quick, you know, hug or a quick word of affirmation.
Wonderful. You know, I mean, they're simple little things, but it sounds like they're very important in maintaining a loving relationship and a communicating relationship as well. And, you know, when things, people are together, they've had a child, they're doing this together, are you able to keep the emotion out of the consultation and the relationship, so to speak? Are they more willing to talk about all this, to come in and say, well, you know, I don't feel as loved as I once was. Maybe we can look at these other languages that can be helpful. Or is there always a lot of emotion involved in dealing with people when they're dealing with loss of love?
There is a lot of emotion. And I think being able to be curious and try to figure out what's underneath it, because I always say it's never really, the fight about the remote control is never really about the remote control, right? There's something else
yep.
underneath that fight. And so if we can get to, are you feeling like you don't have influence? Are you feeling like you're not heard? Because I think those are the big things that lose that connection for people, is feeling like they're not heard, they're not valued, they're not important to the other person. So those cares and those values that are underneath get taken over by the fights over who didn't do the laundry or why is your cup of coffee still sitting on the table from breakfast. And it's never
sure.
about those things. So we try to go a little bit deeper. But what I have found to be powerful is giving people behaviors to try out. Behaviors can change a little bit more quickly than just those feelings change. But you also have to notice when the other person is doing something good for you. It's almost like making little deposits into a bank account of positive. If you feel like you've gone negative in your relationship, just like in your bank account, if you go negative, it takes an awful lot to have to put that back up. So you're not getting the late fee charges. So I always say you have to deposit frequently throughout the day in the beginning because you're trying to get out of the late fee charges with your partner. And so we make a plan, sometimes individually or sometimes together as a couple, to say what are the things that you can do to make deposits into the other person's love bank. And then we reflect on it. At the end of the day, I have them journal it as well to say, did I feel that my partner did this? And then to the partner who's supposed to be doing it, did I actually do these things? Again, it's almost like if we were hooked up to a heart monitor, we could see what was actually happening to our heart. We can't really do that with some of these things yet, but maybe technology will come that way. But we need to find a way to get people to acknowledge and gain insight and see that, oh, wait, that thing that you did, oh, that was a bit of positive, you know, deposit. Sure. And, okay, I do see it now. And so because we miss those things, right? Our brains are biologically wired to see the negative before the positive, so we sometimes miss those things.
Right.
So I give them behavioral things to do, and they have to check in and be accountable in the next session, which tends to help.
No, beautiful. You know, Dr. Gilman, what are the signs that maybe the relationship is going downhill, that, you know, maybe there is a love loss here? You know, what do you start to notice? Criticism that, you know, overall your spouse is not as loving and warm. You know, what are the signs here that one could be aware of that they could say that, you know what, I think that I need some help. You know, things aren't as good as they once were. You know, what are they? Yeah, my goddamn it, the coffee cup is still on the table. You know, the criticisms, the critiques. What have you found?
Yeah, it's that. I mean, exactly what you're saying. It's sort of like turning away. You know, if someone is talking that you're sort of not really responding, maybe you're on your phone, you're like, versus like what maybe used to happen where they would actually be able to sit and talk and have a good conversation.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when there's a lot of fighting and you don't feel like a team, you don't feel like friends anymore, you don't even feel like that person has your back, and you're not really crazy about spending a lot of time with each other. Maybe the person's going, you know, to the gym more or staying at work later or, you know, making plans with friends instead of your own rituals of connecting.
Wow. So those are the telltale signs that maybe the relationship is not as warm and fuzzy and friendly and loving that maybe it was once that it started out as. You know, we hear about relationships that, my God, you know, people get married. Their relationship is fantastic. It's wonderful. And then over time, the relationship dwindles. You know, they don't have that loving as much as they once did. You know, what's happening? How does that happen? That it starts out, you know, they've been dating for 2 years. Then they want to get married. Then they get married, and after 3 or 4 or 5 months, the relationship seems to be in trouble. What have you seen?
Well, I think two things that we see, right? One is the fact that, you know, oxytocin, that love hormone, it does tend to go away, right? Like the high levels of dopamine and norepinephrine that come in when you're attracted, they start to kind of like fade away a little bit. But the other things that I think happen is, you know, life gets busy. And so all that excitement about dating and maybe, you know, planning your wedding and then you're buying a house and then you're having the baby.
Right.
Like all these things give you these things to look forward to. And then after that, it's kind of like Groundhog Day, right? Like everything is, there's nothing more to maybe look forward to. So I always say to couples, to plan something to look forward to. Have these little rituals of connecting that at the end of the week, you're looking forward to maybe taking a hike together, taking a walk together, seeing what's at the movie theater that you want to go together, maybe trying a new restaurant once a week. So you have to build in these little sparks that allow you to look forward to things, because at the beginning of the relationship, that's really what you're doing. There's always something else that's exciting that's coming. And, you know, to have that Groundhog Day makes you sort of feel like exhausted of the relationship after a while. And also making sure that you're staying connected and talking with one another, right? Like, who are your friends now? What's going on at work now? You're getting into their world so that you're forming that connection even deeper.
And, you know, is it not a little more difficult once the relationship seems to be going downhill to rekindle? It takes more energy, I would think, to reestablish communications, to go ahead and show interest again. Maybe there's hurt feelings. You know, maybe there's a lot of stress. Is that when maybe the couples may need counseling if they can't rekindle that on their own?
Absolutely. That's a great time to come in and talk because, again, as a neutral person who's on the side of your relationship, as the psychologist, I might be able to point out patterns or things that I'm noticing that are happening that they don't notice they're doing themselves that could be interfering with that relationship. So as they're sitting in my office and talking and maybe I'm noticing behaviors that are happening or communication patterns that are happening, I'll point them out and I'll give them a strategy that we know can help them improve that. Or maybe have to work on them one-on-one to talk with them about, you know, how they can be better at handling some of these different relationship difficulties. Again, a lot of these things also can come from the way we were raised and how our parents modeled different things for us. So some things may require a little bit more intensive introspection to work on the things individually and not just always say it's him or her. You know, sometimes we don't like to take responsibility for our own behavior.
No,
so
I
we
agree.
Like to deflect and say it's because of this other thing when it really could be us who could do some fixing.
Excellent answers. Dr. Gilman, we're going to go to the studio in L.A. We have a lot of questions. Maybe we can get Mark Mancini back on the phone here. Mark, what do you have for us in L.A. in the studio?
Well, as the show keeps progressing, I got a few of these, and I'll bring them to your attention. Fran from Des Moines, Iowa says, I think the biggest thing in relationships is communication. People grow apart. The candle goes out after you create a friendship and you get married, and I just think people got to communicate more. I'm enjoying the show.
Well, I agree, and Doctor, go ahead, please.
Yeah, 100%. I absolutely agree. And I think communication is both a speaker and a listener. I think people forget how to really listen to one another. And the longer you're married, I think the more we tend to guess what our spouse might be saying or fill in the blank without suspending that judgment and actually waiting to hear what they're really saying. And so we tend to interrupt or you know, I think people say, oh, it's so cute. We know each other so well. We can fill in each other's sentences or finish each other's sentences. And I'm always like, uh-oh, that's not great. Because you want to really hear what your partner's communicating to you. So listening and responding in really soft and positive ways and curious ways and even asking, you know, magical questions and dreamy questions and questions about what the future would look like for the two of you is really nice. And unplugging from those phones and all those other distractions are important when we're communicating.
Sure. And, you know, if I can interrupt here as well, Doctor, how difficult is it to change behaviors? You know, if one, we're married, children, things like that, and they're in a certain behavior pattern. How long does it take you to say, hey, we need to change some things. Here's what you need to do. I mean, is it several sessions? Is it several months? You know, how quickly are people willing to adapt to make things better?
Well, and I think you just said the key. How willing are people to do it? So that would really be what I see to be the difference. If someone is willing to change, is willing to accept the influence of the other partner to say, this is what I need from you, and they are really wanting to do it, it doesn't really take that much time, right? As long as they are becoming self-aware of the things that they need to do, they're expressing, and that the other partner is noticing. So what behavioral psychology will tell us is Behaviors that are rewarded will increase. Behaviors that are punished or ignored decrease or go on extinction.
Sure.
So we have to be paying attention when our partner does something that we like. We have to tell them that we liked that. Thank you so much for listening to me today. I really appreciated that you called me at lunch just to check in and say hi or, you know, anything. You loaded the dishwasher today, and I noticed that. It took such a burden off of me. So that noticing is huge.
And those small things. You know, if I can interrupt, Mark, you know, what happens, Dr. Gilman, if there's infidelity in a relationship? You know, it breaks down to that point, and they're trying to get back together. Are those hurt feelings difficult to mend, to forgive, to reestablish trust? How do you do that?
Yeah, it is really hard. I mean, breaking of a promise to remain faithful to your partner is really hurtful. And I think as unthinkable as it is, I think that trust can be rebuilt as long as the person who has, you know, broken the trust is able to be accountable for that. And it really is a sign that something else was happening in the relationship, usually. I mean, now some people do have some, you know, other addictions around sex that might be a little bit more difficult to continue to keep somebody in that relationship. But if both people want to be in that relationship, that there is an ability to repair it. And it is hard. And I would think that they both would need some individual therapy as in addition to the couple's therapy to really talk about how they can get back together and if they can get back together.
Wow. And Dr. Gilman, do you see where you need to repair relationships like that? Is that part of your practice in doing that and helping people reestablish or rekindle?
I have done that, yes. And, you know, there's a little piece of my practice that's called discernment counseling. So when people are trying to decide should they stay or should they go, and they're in that, we have a method that we follow for discernment counseling that tries to help partners see, are they able to stay in this relationship or should they leave this relationship? And that's the decision that they make themselves through a series of steps and interventions that follow a specific protocol.
So those are some of the heavy-duty things you have to deal with. I'm Mr. Mancini. Go ahead from L.A.
Yeah, let me throw one more, and then I'll let you guys get back to as this show progresses. Jack from Solvang, California, basically says, listening to the show, and he wanted to throw out a question to you, Dr. Deborah Gilman, about how tough is it when you lose a loved one, the strain on a relationship. Now there's a blame game and, you know, and stuff like that. That tends to ruin marriages, too. Whether it's a child involved or something, is that true?
It can be, right? So there can also be a tremendous amount of guilt, you know, and there can also be a lot of turning away from one another because you're in a painful, traumatic situation, and sometimes it's hard to want to, if both of you are going through that same loss together, it is so hard for couples to want to maybe put their sadness or grief onto the other person because they feel like they would feel guilty doing that or they feel bad about burdening the other person when they're dealing with the grief as well. And so I often see people not wanting to share and be vulnerable with one another, not because they don't love them, but because they're trying to protect them. And so what I like to do is say we have to have these difficult conversations. We have to talk about those things. And the other person often wants them to share, say, what? Why would you hide that from me? I wanted to know that. Like, here you are either, you know, being really strong and going out and acting like this hasn't affected you at all, which now the other partner feels like, well, there's no room for me to be grieving, and I feel bad that I'm grieving because look at my partner just functioning. And they're actually both feeling usually the same way, expressing it differently sometimes. But when we get them to talk about it, it actually brings them so much closer. So if you've lost someone, I definitely think going to a family therapist, a couples therapist, would really be helpful in creating that space to have those really hard conversations because they're hard to do without it. Because, again, there's so much emotion tied up in the loss that both people have.
Very good. Mark, do you have another one for right now?
Yeah, let me get Dalen from Chelmsford, Massachusetts, coming through, and he basically says the same thing. Relationships are hard. He's got a friend, and maybe you could shed some light on this. They live together. They bought a house together, but they're not married. Has that become a trust factor? Because if you live with somebody a long time and you purchase a house together, wouldn't you think the trust factor would carry you to being married? I can't figure that one out, and that's coming out from Massachusetts. That's a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. And I think, it's interesting when people, when people choose the pathways that they choose. Sometimes I see people cohabitate maybe because they're – and not get married because they had parents who had really bad marriages or really bad divorces, and they're afraid that if they get married, they might repeat those same things. I see other people who feel like, we don't need to get married to show that we have a committed relationship with one another, and that we want to just live this way. And a lot of people do that as well. And I think I read a study not too long ago, and I apologize, I can't remember who said it, but that, the younger generations aren't seeing marriage as important anymore. And so they are cohabitating or staying single even longer. So it's interesting to explore this a little bit further and see what the patterns are and why they happen. But again, it's ultimately up to the people who are in the relationship to decide whether or not they should or shouldn't cohabitate. But I think getting some protection maybe around that relationship and the financial decisions they make is also important for them.
Excellent. I do have, Dr. Gilman, I have a couple of emails. You know what? Handling cultural differences, between a husband and wife, different nationalities, different races, does that present a problem? People come to you to discuss, maybe they're married and now they notice the difference in cultures, in raising children, religion. Do they come in and talk to you about these kind of problems?
I have had people talk about that, and sometimes prior to their marriage, when they're getting more committed to one another, maybe even before they get engaged, I might have couples come into my office to talk about this because of the in-laws or of the extended family perspective. A lot of times people are afraid that their families of origin will be outspoken about the disapproval or concern about what future generations might look like. And again, really, there's a lot of fear, right? Fear that our cultural values or traditions will no longer exist. Fear that people aren't going to want to carry on traditions. Fear of what's going to happen in the community. How will society perceive you or the children? I have had larger things where maybe there have been language barriers, right? So communication itself was just a challenge. And so talking a lot about how they can work together. Sometimes in those cases, I've actually had people, bring in maybe their parents who they were concerned about talking about this, or maybe the parents had rejected. I had one case where the parents really were rejecting the fiance of one of my patients. And so he brought in his parents to talk through it and to, really just say, like, if you can't support me, then you're making a choice to not be in my life, right? And so that was hard. But luckily, as we worked through it, we were able to see that, again, it was just around that fear that things were going to change in their family. And so once we were able to say, this is, we can set up some expectations and everyone talked together, and then the fiance was brought in, and she was like, I'm not trying to disrupt anything. I just love your son, And so it really opened up those lines of communication. And again, it's that underlying stuff that we can really get to in therapy that makes a lot of healing and a lot of progress for everybody to move forward happily. And they actually sent me a picture of after their wedding of all of the whole family, in front of the church, like lined up both sides of the family, and everyone smiling, and they had a lovely day. So again, very simple conversations to have that feel very hard and very difficult, but with the right psychologist or the right therapist, you can actually be able to learn how to bend and flex and compromise and accommodate to one another's ways of looking at life.
You know, very good, very important, because there is a lot of cultural differences that, you know, may come to play in a marriage. And that's a real win, doing something as successful as you've done that. I have another question here, dealing with co-parenting. You know, if the marriage breaks down and they have a child, talk to us about co-parenting. You know, that has to cause an awful lot of stress. There has to be a lot of emotion. And indeed, you know, do parents come to you, or one parent will come to you and want to talk about, how do I co-parent? You know, what's this all about? What are my rights? How do I go ahead and raise this child as well? Can you help us with that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually do a lot of work with co-parents, especially co-parents who are having conflict. I get a lot of referrals through the family courts. And I do a lot of work with parents even before they separate. Again, I love to see people when they're before they're making this big change that everything happens. And so we talk about separation or divorce doesn't end your responsibility of being a parent, right? Parents are forever. And so they have to make every attempt to continue to work together, to be in their child's lives and to allow the other parent to have a healthy, positive relationship with the children. I mean, parents are forever, and so your own sadness about the divorce cannot block how your child is able to interact with mom and dad. So I actually, when I see parents before they even have told their children that they're getting divorced or separated, we do something called a divorce story, where we create a neutral narrative to be honest and sensitive with the children about the separation and divorce in a non-blaming way, so the kids don't have to choose sides. Because I think that is so terrible for children to feel like they're stuck in the middle. Who's good guy? Who's the bad guy? Who's right? Who's wrong? And also making sure that the children know that they're not to blame for it. And then we start talking with the parents about how their relationship together can support the children's relationship with the other parent, regardless of their own feelings. We want to make sure that children have ongoing contact with both parents, that they respect both parents, and that the children are not encouraged or even forced, because I've seen children be forced, to take sides, carry messages, give a little report on what the other person is doing in their house. A lot of that comes from the parents. If the parents are a united front and they're a team and they, you know, stop that right away, or they can keep their communication going, there's no need for the children to get in the middle. They're able to just live their lives and really share the best parts of themselves as parents with the kids.
Got it. And, you know, Dr. Gilman, when you're doing, you know, this type of a co-parenting counseling, do you do this in front of the child? Do you have the parents separately? What is the logistics here about putting this together? How do you put the communication cycle together?
So if I'm seeing parents after they have separated or divorced, typically I'm seeing just them together. Unless there's something that comes up that they feel like they want their child's voice part of it. But I always say kids have a voice. They don't have the choice. You think about, like, when parents are deciding, like, where should we go to dinner on Friday night? The kids might all shout something out, but ultimately it's mom and dad. So same with divorce. Kids might say, oh, I want to spend more time at this house or that house. But it's mom and dad who have to make that choice. They can't put that burden on their children to have to decide. And so, again, it's parents together. I'm giving them a lot of tips. They're telling me where they see their co-parenting barriers to working things out together. And we're working on specific skills. I do a lot of, in-the-moment skill training, as well as giving them worksheets and things to reflect on and learning how to do new ways of operating, because it's not the same as when you're transitioning into parenthood. You're sort of transitioning into your marriage. We're now talking about realigning your relationship. You're now almost more like business partners. You're in the business of raising your kids. So there are different boundaries and different expectations that we absolutely have to talk about, because your roles and your goals as co-parents might be very different than your roles and your goals as an intact family living in one home. If I'm working with a family through like a mediation or through the collaborative process, I am trained as a child specialist where we might have these conversations with the whole family. So again, the kids have their voices heard, but they don't necessarily make the choices, but mom and dad and or mom and mom or dad or dad can explain to the children what is happening. Again, in this safety net environment where we're all working together. There's this really great term, Dr. Roscoe, called liminality. It is a term that means basically like the old ways, it's like a period of transition, right? So the old rules no longer apply. The new rules haven't even been established yet. So you're in this really weird period of liminality. It's anxiety. It's uncertainty. It's not knowing yet. It's like almost like, you know, trial and error, trying to figure all of this out. So a lot of the people that I see in my practice are in this period of liminality, whether you're transitioning to parenthood, whether you're in a separation or divorce situation, you know, when your relationship isn't feeling good. It's kind of like, okay, the old ways aren't working. We got to figure out some new ways, but we're in this really weird, murky, uncertain gray time that feels uncomfortable. Yes. So I try to work with everybody to say, how can we get some guardrails around this period of liminality and allow some space, emotional space, conversational space, so that you guys are creating the new rules together.
Got it. And which is so important, again, as far as communication. You know, I have another question here, Doctor. Why is the divorce rate so high in this country? We believe we're the fourth or fifth highest divorce rate in the industrialized world. Why is that the case?
Yeah, you know, it is, we wish we knew, right, why that is so common today. I really think that people, again, it's communication. It's making sure that you're staying connected. And I think also there used to be a stigma around divorce, and I think that that stigma started to reduce as it became so normalized.
Sure.
And not that it's like a popular thing to do necessarily, but I don't think people see it as a bad thing anymore. And I don't know. I mean, I think people, by the time they see that there's a problem in their marriage or both people have realized that there's a bad, you know, their marriage has hit a bad place.
The love maybe is gone, kind of
give up, right?
Yes.
The love is gone, yeah. But they sort of just feel like, okay, you know, we can't do this anymore. And sometimes people come into counseling, again, like as a last-ditch effort, and sometimes that's really, really hard. But communication problems typically are the number one reason that marriages fail and that people are not able to get on the same page again. And sometimes maybe they weren't on the same page to begin with, like they haven't had a lot of these conversations before their marriage, and that as they continue to change and transition and their identity changes, they forget to check in with each other. So they lose that shared vision of success. They have expectations that are unmet. They feel like they're out of touch with each other. Maybe even their priorities and interests have changed, and that creates conflict. And John Gottman, who's a really big researcher in relationships, says that there are perpetual problems that sort of come around and around and around, and then there are like these smaller, like day-to-day problems that people have to learn how to solve. And sometimes it's hard to solve those day-to-day problems if you have these unsolvable, perpetual problems that are going unresolved as well. So it's good to come in and try to talk about those. Like, are these just day-to-day things, like shifting things in our relationship, or are there some really big perpetual problems that we've had that are really hard to solve?
Got it. And, you know, very good. No, I agree with you. You know, I have two further questions here on our emails. And, again, one is more of a business question. Does insurance pay for this type of counseling and the great services you provide?
That is a good question. So insurance pays for medically necessary services. So if there is a diagnosis that is seen as medically necessary by the insurance company, and you meet DSM-5, which is the criteria that we give as psychologists to people who have a diagnosis, then yes.
Okay.
But in most cases, I would say that the people who I'm seeing in my office are not coming in for medically necessary reasons. They're coming in because they have relationship challenges, family challenges that are of clinical concern but don't rise to that level of a medically necessary diagnosis.
Got it. I got it. And, you know, with regard to, say, summarizing, Dr. Gilman, with regard to the keys to maintaining a successful relationship, what would you tell our listeners? What's the key here to trying to maintain a healthy marital relationship and to keep your family unit intact? Could you give us some pointers here on that?
I think the biggest thing is communication. I mean, we've talked about it a lot here, and it really is communicating, because you communicate about everything, your hopes, your dreams, what's going on for you in the relationship, how you need support from your partner, even difficult things like money, right? Money is another reason why people get divorced frequently.
Oh,
they
yeah.
cite that. And so talking about money, because it's symbolic of emotional needs like safety, power, it goes along with all of these things. The more you can communicate with your partner and really the other partner really listen, you both listen to one another, and look for those win-win solutions. I always say to look for those compromises, those yes and moments, and how you can actually see each other's perspective. You don't have to agree with it. I think sometimes when I say to someone, can you see what they're saying? Yeah, but I don't think. And it's like, okay, you don't have to agree with it. But that validation that you know that you're heard and you know that other person has really, truly seen you, that is huge in a marriage or in any relationship, really. And so to be able to communicate, both speak and listen, and have that shared meaning around that conversation, even if it's a hard conversation, and there are going to be a lot of hard conversations in relationships, but to be able to sit through it and listen, I think, is 100% the key to success.
Wow. And, you know, as far as I think you were mentioning, people listening to each other and, you know, people talk, but you don't hear. How do you do that? What tool do you use to say, no, wait a minute, you know, she said this. What did you hear? All right. And maybe they give you something different. How do you work on that?
That is exactly what you're saying, right? So when we listen, we have to listen to understand in relationships. And so body language is huge. Making sure that you're turning toward your partner and you're having eye contact with both of them. That you're waiting for the complete message to be communicated before you interrupt or become distracted, that you're repeating back and say, okay, let me make sure I get this right. I heard you say blah, blah, blah. And then let the other person say, yes, you got it. Or not quite, here's what I said, right? So what I'm hearing is really good things. Sounds like you're saying this. And, you know, if you don't understand what the person is saying, ask a clarifying question. So, like, do you mean, or let me make sure I have this right. When you say, I'm not helping a lot, what does that mean? Right? Because they might say, I'm helping a heck of a lot, right? Like, I see myself doing everything around here. The other thing is I statements. When you're communicating, if you're the person who's the speaker, using an I statement instead of a you never and you don't do this, saying an I, like I feel overwhelmed, I feel like I need a break sometimes, that actually allows the other person to not feel defensive. They then understand your perspective. If you start saying you, then the other person is just going to start tallying up in their heads all the times that they've done the thing or haven't done the thing that you're accusing them of doing, or they're going to, you know, be defensive and fight back. And I do think it's okay to summarize comments, you know, defer judgment for sure.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Doctor, we have a few more questions here that I'd love to hear some answers from you. Mark in L.A. again, go ahead.
Yeah, and we're up against it, and we can go for hours. We got to bring her back on this show. I got a couple quick ones with the last 5 minutes and some change left, but Brad from Youngstown, Ohio, chiming in, he says, you know, why is it that a lot more marriages are broken up after the kids get older and move out of the house? That should be the time where you rekindle the magic that got you there in the first place. Just seems that there's so many marriages being torn apart, and the grass ain't always greener on the other side, especially when you spend time with somebody over 20-something years. Wow, great question.
That is a great question. Yeah, I mean, that's called gray divorce is what people are calling that in the literature right now. And really, I think it goes back to that role, right? Like, sometimes your identity gets lost in raising the kids and supporting them and getting the kids to where they need to go, that you forget who each of you are in the relationship. You forget to stay connected as your own goals for your life start to change, and you know, you maybe lose that connection with your partner because you don't feel, now what do I have in common, right? It's that empty nest syndrome. It's like, now what are we supposed to do? Talk to each other, look at each other? So I do think it's really important, again, to go back to those love language, go back to connecting with each other, making that those rituals of connecting by actively engaging in activities that increase emotional closeness, and focusing on the two of you as partners, not just parents, because once the kids are out of the nest, now you're like, wait, we're just parents? We don't even know why we're here together if we don't have our kids.
Wow.
Great.
Go ahead, Mark.
I'll throw one more, and then we'll start to wind it down. Fran from Brookline, Mass goes, you know, I just heard your question regarding, you know, does insurances pick this up? It's sad because a lot of these problems today would focus on mental health, and you think the insurances would pick this up as far as what's going on in families across the country. Wow, that is a great one as well.
Yeah. Doctor, what do you see about that?
Yeah, I agree. I would love that too. I mean, I think that when concerns have risen to a place of clinical help, you would hope that they would be that there would be some understanding of prevention, right? But it's a hard thing, and I think legislation, talk to your legislator, you know, reach out to the people who make these rules for our insurance reimbursement.
Sure.
And I think prevention is certainly worth it. If we can prevent things before they go bad, we can certainly help people a little bit more.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing, Dr. Gilman, is when people are shopping for insurance, they need to look at what the benefits are. You know, what is being paid for? What services, you know, that I need, are they being covered? So it takes a little bit of homework on our listeners' part to make sure they get the right coverage for the health issues that they have. Do you find that true?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Mancini, go ahead.
Well, we're down to a minute, and I'd like to know if anybody's listening here and they want to get a hold of you, Dr. Deborah Gilman, how would they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can go to my website. It's www.drdrdebgilman. It's one L in Gilman, DebGilman.com. I have a lot of resources there. You can email me. You can call me.
And, Doc, if I give it over to you, in the Pittsburgh area as well, with your fine establishment and all the great people that work over there for you and everything, how would they get a hold of you in the greater Pittsburgh area?
They can, you know, as they normally do, GJRMD 308 at Outlook.com. I'd like to summarize this. I think Dr. Gilman would agree that in a marital relationship, communication is one of the big tools in the toolbox that helps to maintain a relationship and to solve problems in the relationship. And are you in agreement with that, Dr. Gilman?
100%. Helps you also stay connected in that relationship.
Excellent. Mr. Mancini, you want to close the show?
Well, I definitely can't wait till next week when your guest coming through will be Mr. Schindler. He'll be coming through next week as the shows keep progressing, and it's just unbelievable what is going on here in each and every week, and we can't wait to get Dr. Deborah Gilman back in here, too.
I'm re-inviting her. And next week, we're talking about income tax and health care expenses that will be deductible. So it might save you some money listening next week. So thank you, Dr. Gilman. Thank you, Mr. Mancini.
My pleasure. Love to come back anytime.
Yes.
Thank you.
And catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, wherever you subscribe to the podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. Thanks for tuning in. Have a blessed and safe weekend. We'll talk to you next week, same time, same channel.
Thank you.